Pentecost, the only church of all Christians, which I think in our day of much talk and discussions and committees, we have a tendency to forget. One of the things about this whole subject of mysticism that is kind of the theme of this weekend is the fact that the people who are involved in any kind of experience, whatever we want to call it, in relationship to God, have to be people who are willing to be silent, who are willing to be alone, who are willing to spend time in prayer. There isn't any way in which you can shortcut to this experience that I think deep in all of us, we all want. And we all think, well, there must be a deep freeze approach, you know. There should be an instant spiritual experience. Why isn't there an instant Christianity? Why isn't there something that is dehydrated and all we have to do is pour a little water on it and wow, there we are. Well, in a sense, I suppose we do pour water on it. The pastor pours water on us and we do become Christians by baptism. That's probably one instance, but it's certainly not a dehydrated kind of relationship that is sort of reinstated by any means. The prospect of having to spend time on something always irritates people. One of the big problems with Holden is the fact it takes so long to get here. And then after you get to Salem, you've got to take that long boat trip. Well, that really is a problem. And yet, as George Utech, one of the poets who was up here one of our first years, said, in a sense, it is a real period in which, if people would only expect it to be that way, could be a preparation for a retreat experience for themselves, because as you start on the boat, you begin to shed, almost unconsciously, some of the problems of driving, some of the problems of housework, some of the problems of the telephone, the television, the radio, even the newspaper. And it all kind of begins to flow away from you, and you begin to move into what is, in a sense, another world, and yet we have plenty of the real world right here, as I'm sure most of you know. When we talked about having mysticism as a subject, a Christ mysticism, as a subject for this year's seminar, I don't know whether Carol mentioned the fact that he has often been accused of he has often been accused of being a mystic. And that not everybody can have that kind of enthusiasm, you know, as Hinderly has got. You know, he's kind of a queer and has all his mystical enthusiasm for Christ, and it gets to be kind of a cult and a thing and so on. And, you know, knowing how ornery Carol gets, you know, he gets really on his high horse and he gets decided, well, he was convinced this was not the truth. And he just thought, why don't we talk about it? Why don't we think about this whole problem of, is there a Christ mysticism? Now, some of you may not have bothered to look up in the dictionary to find out what mysticism means. And so for those of you who didn't have access to a dictionary, some people don't play Scrabble, I will read you the dictionary definition and then explain to you how this relates to the seminar that we are using. The experience of mystical or direct communion with ultimate reality or God based on intuition, insight, or similar subjective experience, inducing a feeling of awe and wonder, neither apparent to the senses nor obvious to the intelligence. Now this sounds like a lot of words thrown together, and I assume that in a sense this is what dictionary makers do. They do string words together and they never put in any transitions. But I think that if we understand that the mystical experience is the experience of the person or the creature as we are with the Creator. This is what it is in terms of just a non-Christian explanation. And there are mystical saints, if you want to call them that, or people who are mystics in all the religions of the world. And so when people talk about somebody as being a mystic, as they probably were referring to Carol, they were sort of saying, you know, he's just an enthusiast, like a lot of people are in all sorts of different religions, and that's just a psychological experience. That's not Christianity. And I think that you've probably gathered, if you've had your ears open, from the Bible studies, that this kind of mysticism, if that's what it is, that Carol is talking about, and that many of us, I think many of us here in this room know, is not a peculiar psychological experience, but it is one that is unique to a relationship with Jesus Christ. And the experiences of the mystics in Hinduism and in the Sufis, for example, in Mohammedanism, the people who belong to the particular contemplative group amongst the Buddhists, when you start reading them and read along with them some of the medieval mystics of the Roman Catholic Church and some of the mystics even of the Protestant Church, you find that there's a lot of similarity and an identity that makes you realize that being a mystic is not necessarily being a Christian, and that the determining factor in the experience is the relationship with Jesus Christ and the fact that he is the dominating and the power-producing person in the relationship. That it is not some kind of a misty and swimming kind of a feeling that you get when you are related to Jesus Christ as he is in the Gospels and in the Epistles, but that it is a relationship with a person that is dynamic and powerful and life-changing day by day. And it is not an experience that draws you away from life, away from people, but leads you into life and into involvement with people. And this is quite different from the common experience and the pattern of most of the mystics as you study them in the history of religion, because you find that the tendency is rather towards removal from the crowded ways of life and the sense of withdrawal from the bother of the scratchiness of ordinary living. And this is why, for instance, one of my favorites of the saints of the church is Brother Lawrence. And the interesting thing about it, and it's a real commentary on this whole understanding of mysticism, is that the people around him who were in the monastery with him said, how can you be a saint, and how can you really be related to God in a real presence, as you claim to be, when you're washing pans and you're clanging around in the scullery? And he simply said that he could practice the presence of God, he could converse with God, he could pray to God when he was in the midst of things. And this, to me, is a far more real kind of life of mysticism, if that's what you're concerned and interested in, than a kind of life in which you try to get as far away as you can from that which interrupts and seems to deflect you from this one idea of becoming one with the infinite. Of attaining what the history of all the Roman Catholic patterns of mysticism call unitive prayer, so that you become finally absorbed so totally in this prayer experience that you lose your relationship as a person and God as another person, and you become one. Now, the high priestly prayer of Jesus in the 17th chapter of John is one that many of the mystics use who are in the Christian tradition as an example, and they say, you know, this is what we are aiming for, to be one. But you can't read any of the Gospels out of context like that. And as those of you who were in the study of the Gospel of John last night were aware, Jesus somehow doesn't hit you as a mystic. He just isn't. He's just alive, incarnate, fleshy person, walking around, making trouble for everybody, loving people, disturbing people, giving peace to people, and it's anything but the kind of pattern picture that you have from the so-called traditional mystic idea. You might wonder why we should talk about something like this, or why should people discuss anything in terms of theology anyway? Why shouldn't we just pray and read the Bible and sing hymns and have a sermon and be encouraged that way and then have the sacraments and so on? Why have a lecture? Why talk to each other about these things? What is there that gives us any basis for this? Well, you know, if you read Scripture, you realize that the God that we are involved with is not a God who says, don't touch me, don't talk to me, don't question me. He's not some great all way off, far away, that says, I don't want to have anything to do with my people. But you find all through the Old Testament as well as the New Testament that this is a God who loves so tremendously that he's willing to be involved, and as Carol said this morning about that little quote, he's willing to be hurt, which he was. And Charles Williams, who is also one of my favorite guys, I've done a lot of favorite writers, but that's why I don't do any writing myself, because I figure that everybody else has done such a good job. Why should I, Father? I'm also lazy. But Charles Williams has a very good statement on this, and I think that we need to think about it, because you'll find that a lot of people will say to you, you know, I think you could do better if you spent more time in prayer. Or I think you could do better if you do this or that or the other thing, instead of talking about something. But there is a need for clarification. And if we're going to talk to people who are not Christians, people who don't know who this Lord is, we've got to give a reason for the faith that's in us. And we have to be able to clarify it in a way that can be understood by people who, aren't in the so-called in-group. Maybe they don't know the language of John. Maybe they don't know about all these things. And maybe we ourselves need to clarify some things for our own minds and spirits so that we can be more free and more fresh in our witness and in our living. Many people say, our little minds, how can they probe the mysteries of God? And Charles Williams says, I don't know whether people say this in love or laziness. This word, our little minds, were never meant. But fortunately, there is the book of Job to make it clear that our little minds were meant. A great curiosity ought to exist concerning divine things. Man was intended to argue with God. And if you just stop and think a minute about the history of the patriarchs and of the people in the Old Testament, you know, they didn't take anything lying down. They were the most argumentative, fussy, irritating, stubborn people, and they were always saying no to God, and then finally you'd have to overwhelm them, so they said yes. But certainly they didn't all start out saying, yes, God, yes, God, yes, God. They didn't. And for us to act as if they did is a lack of understanding of our own scriptures. Just think about Abraham. And what he said, when remember when the angel said he was going to have a son?
He kind of, well, he got ready, but you know, there wasn't that kind of open feeling. And you know, what did Sarah do?
Anybody remember what Sarah did?
She laughed.
She laughed at God. And God took it.
And then you remember Jacob?
You know, he wrestled. He wrestled and he wrestled and he wrestled. And he said, I'm not going to leave until I know your name. And I don't think anybody who has prayed the Psalms of David who can possibly say that the God that we pray to is a God that cannot be questioned, that cannot be talked to, that cannot be related to in a very personal way. And so it's not all that bad to talk and think and try to straighten out some things in our minds about our faith or about our relationship with God or our relationship with each other. We spend a lot of time these days about our ethical relationships, about what we've done wrong in our past as a history, in the history of the church, in the nation, our relationship with racial problems, for example, our relationship with labor and so on, and we certainly are walking around with plenty of guilt on this side, and we've talked about it, and we air it, and we discuss it. So I think that it isn't all that bad to discuss some of the other side of our life, which really ought to be the motivating force in the whole life of the church. Even Mary, you know, how does she respond when the angel comes to her and tells her that she is going to be the mother of her Lord? What does she say? How can these things be? It's a question. She just didn't say, God said so, and shut her mouth. Or we might say, well, if she did say something, how come they allowed it to be, you know, printed? Because if it was proper that she should have kept quiet, then we should never have read it in the New Testament. No, it was right that she said, how can these things be? And then when later on when she goes to see Elizabeth and you hear this wonderful Magnificat and you realize that how can these things be? The mystery of it has become so wonderful to her, and she realizes that this is the God that she knows from the Old Testament, and she uses all these quotations from the Old Testament scriptures as she prays this hymn of praise to the God who has overwhelmed her and has answered her question. Not in so many words, but so that she can respond by saying that my soul doth magnify the Lord. And this is the kind of God we have. He's not a God that can't be talked to. He's not a God that can't be thought about. He's not a God who can't be, you know, reached toward. Otherwise, why would Jesus have come and become incarnate if God wanted to remain away from us? So the whole life of the church is involved in a relationship of prayer, yes, and meditation, yes, and praise. But it is also a life of conversation. There was a conversation with the disciples, with their Lord, and there's a conversation amongst the disciples. And there's a conversation amongst 20th century disciples, too, so that our witness, as I said, can be clear and strong to those who are without. So there is a point to having seminars on religious subjects. I thought this was important to bring out because in the summertime we discuss a great deal use a great deal of material on things that are not really directly involved in Christian experience. We have lectures on history and economics and philosophy and literature.
nature, and they're all more or less objective subjects. Then they're related to the life of the person who lives in the kingdom of God, certainly. But it's not the sort of the inside life that comes out. And this is why I felt that I had to sort of make a statement as to why we can discuss these things without feeling like we're hanging out our private linen. It's perfectly right to talk as long as talking isn't the end of it. Now we have in the Church of Jesus Christ two strains, the Roman Catholic and the Protestant. Now there's also the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is not as common in our background and in our knowledge as the two that are part of the Western tradition. And in thinking about this whole thought of a Christ mysticism, a real mysticism, if we want to use that term, which Cheryl and I, every time we bring it up, Cheryl really sees red, and I almost see too, because you feel like it's kind of a sloppy term. It doesn't really relate necessarily, as I said, to a uniquely Christian experience. But if we want to use that term simply as a direct experience with God through Jesus Christ, let's just use the term and understand that we don't consider it as being the sort of the nameplate of Christianity. But it is a phenomenon in the, you might say, in the psychology of the religious life. And it's true, as I said, of these other religions as well as ours. The only reason that we didn't use the Roman Catholic tradition is that, strangely enough, the Roman Catholic tradition of mysticism and this whole reporting of the inner experience of the person with God in Jesus Christ, the Roman Catholic tradition runs according to a very strong pattern. It's a pattern that was known in the monastic training. And most of the people, if this were a Roman Catholic retreat in the old traditional style, we would be spending a great deal of time in silence, in meditation, and following a certain kind of exercise, religious exercise. This is the type of thing that the nuns and the brothers in the different monasteries followed, and it was the way in which you were supposed to eventually, if you followed this way seriously and sincerely enough, you would eventually come to an experience of this unitive prayer. You'd come to this great experience of knowing God and being swept out of yourself and finding a sort of a sense of awe and wonder that you could hardly speak about. This was typical of all the Roman Catholic mystics. Now, in the Protestant tradition, and the little book of the only book that we could find on Protestant mysticism was a little book, a little paperback, edited by Anne Freemantle, and with an excellent introduction by W.H. Auden, a book that is no longer available. So that was a big help. That's why I'm giving the talk to somehow give you some of the background that would have been available to you had you been able to get the book. In this book, W.H. Auden explains in the introduction that the interesting thing about Protestants, when they are reporting the experience that they are having with Jesus Christ, their relationship with God, they all start on an uncharted course. In other words, they go from where you are right now to wherever you go in the future. There isn't any map, because we don't have patterns of this nature in the Protestant tradition.
there aren't lines drawn, there aren't steps to take, there aren't certain prayers to follow, and therefore the history and the reporting is all very different. This is why you get something like Pilgrim's Progress, which is the report of a person's response and desire to communicate his experience with Jesus Christ, and you get a whole brand new kind of reporting of it. It's not the kind of thing that you would find if you were reading, for instance, Julian of Norwich, or St. Francis, or St. Teresa, or St. John of the Cross, or any of those people who are the great saints of the Roman Catholic tradition. It isn't that we don't get something from these people. It's not that they aren't dedicated or that they are not Christians or anything of that sort, but that we just aren't not in that particular style, and that's why we don't follow that particular pattern. The Protestant tradition is therefore an individual one. If you're going to get acquainted with Jesus Christ, if you're going to have an experience with him, it's got to be yours. You don't have anybody else to tell you how to do it. The only thing we've got is the catechism, and sometimes I think that's a hyper-protection for people, because they think if they know the catechism, that's a sure safeguard, they're never going to stray. Well, I know lots of strays from the Lutheran catechism. Or maybe you don't, but I do. And I've been one. So I don't think you can always say that any kind of patterning is going to be a fence to protect you. You do have to find out for yourself who Jesus Christ is and what kind of relationship he's going to have with you. The interesting thing about Christianity, I think, is its individuality, and is the fact that, as Carol said this morning, you're you and I'm me, and thank goodness there aren't two of each of us. We're one of a kind, each one. And the great thing about our Lord is that he deals with us individually, so that we do have this one-of-a-kind relationship with him. And yet, we somehow manage to talk the same language, and that's really interesting, that we've been able to learn a similar vocabulary, at least so we can understand each other when we talk, and it isn't as if we had to go into some kind of a trance or sit around and smoke pot and hold hands and feel that we were of one kind. Now that I mention that, I might say that several years ago, when LSD was first discovered, I remember an article in the Atlantic Monthly on Timothy Leary and the fact that this drug had been discovered that could very well be a shortcut to religious experiences, and that it had been used by the Mexicans and also by the Indians. I thought, oh, wow, this is really going to be a problem, because if people figure they're going to get a fast route, they'll take it, and then they won't have to go the slow one the rest of us had to go, and that's not fair. Well, I didn't really think all that, but, I mean, that sounds good. But it is true that it was a shock, and it really worried me. I had no idea it was going to go into the world-shaking kind of events that it has gone at this point. But I did feel that this could very well be an attempt to find a way to get to God without going through Jesus Christ, without having the change take place in you that has to take place when you get acquainted with anybody, and certainly if you're getting acquainted with someone who is as tremendous and who is wholly other as God is. And it has been a problem, and it is a shortcut,
And a lot of people do take that shortcut because they want an experience that is other than all this mechanical, metallic kind of life that we live. And so they take a drug, or they smoke something, or they do something that will kind of carry them out of this world that seems so nitty gritty and so ugly. And the great thing about Christian experience is that it doesn't do that. The great thing and the shaking thing about it is that it takes you to Jesus Christ. And then Jesus Christ says, and now you go. And you don't stay there on any kind of Mount of Transfiguration. The mystics in general have all attest to the same central fact, and that is that they have had a one-to-one relationship, if you want to put it that way, a real encounter with God in a way that has changed their whole life. Now, that's not all that different from the way we feel as Christians. The only thing is, there are people in the Christian church who have lived in the Christian church all their lives and have never known that kind of encounter. Sometimes it's because they've been afraid of it, because some of them have had hang-ups about it, because they've had a lot of heavy-handed evangelists on them when they were young, and they just figured, not for me. Maybe it's because they've seen people go completely berserk when this experience has gotten hold of them. But whatever it is, for some people, they just pushed it away. But it was never intended. If you read the New Testament, you realize that Jesus never came to earth just for people to believe something with their mouths. He came in order that he would be involved with individuals. And this is what Christianity is. And this is why, when we talk about mystics, and I was talking to Karen and Bruce and Artis last night in the linen room when we were dishing out sheets, and we were talking about, you know, well, maybe I am a mystic, Karen said. And I immediately gave her a big diatribe on, you know, how bad that was. Well, it isn't that being a mystic is so bad. It's just that the connotation is such that we do have to be a little careful of how we use it. The other thing that I thought was particularly important in that linen room conversation was the fact that Bruce Burrington said that he thought that what people needed and what people wanted was to have the power of God released in their lives, and that they really had a desire for this. And I think this is exactly the case. I think this is why, this is whether people call it the power of God or not. They want something that comes from someplace else because they're so sick and tired of the way things are. But the amazing thing about the way that the New Testament runs is that Jesus, as the Son of God, doesn't take any, you know, snap of the fingers approach. He goes to the trouble of being born, and he grows, and he even has to be circumcised, and he does the whole bit, and he goes around and gets criticized, and he deals with the disciples who don't understand. All these things are nitty-gritty life. They're daily living. There is a vast root. And you know, we all figure there ought to be, but there isn't. And this is why when you talk about the mystical prayer life and so on, that's not a fast route either. The people took a long time to discipline, to be ascetic, to give up certain things so that they could be completely empty of themselves and finally get to the point where there was nothing there, then they could accept the greatness of this experience of God. But the life
of Jesus Christ is not that kind of life. And what you get in most of the Protestants who are supposedly written up as mystics is a combination of a kind of a Roman Catholic tradition, but there's always this sense of their having been picked up in the middle of life, in medias res, as we used to say in Latin, that's where the mystics always begin. They don't begin with a whole lot of preliminaries. Right in the things. That's where you start the Aeneas, and that's where you start the whole situation of whatever is going on, or whatever relationships you're going to have, whatever plot your life is going to take. You don't start always way back at the beginning, but always it starts in the middle of things. And that's where these mystics usually were too. They were in the middle of life. And John Bunyan, as you know, wrote his particular contribution when he was in jail. He was in jail because he was a rebel. And when you think of the fact that Protestant means protest, it means rebel, it isn't because we're so peaceful and kind and gentle that we're called Protestants. We're called Protestants because we belong to a church that did rebel and that did say something has to change. And this is the way John Bunyan was. And this is true of quite a number of the people who were in this Protestant mystic tradition. They were people for whom the life in Jesus Christ was so revolutionary to them that it, instead of drawing them away from life, it plunged them directly into it. And in being plunged directly into it, they naturally were at cross purposes very often with the way things were. And when they got into that situation, what happened? They lots of times got put into jail. Well, sometimes it was a good thing they were put into jail because they did some good writing there. And lots of people don't write until they get incarcerated. There are a number of writings that I would just like to refer to because some of them that are listed that really shouldn't be listed in any kind of a Christian a book that is supposedly involved with Christian experiences. But I am going to just mention their names so that if you happen to run into them, you might take a look at them and see what you think about it. There are a group of poets in the 17th century in England who are called the metaphysical poets. And you don't have to write that word down or think about it, but that happens to be their name. That group of poets were in the Episcopalian or Anglican prison. And one of them that we must know is John Dee, because his quotation, we all have heard, "No man is an island." And another one from another one of his greats is "Death, be not proud." He had a great number of great sermons, and he wrote a great number of poems. And all of them are involved with his experience with Jesus Christ. But they're not, it's not something that goes along a way in which you become swept off into some great nothingness, a great sea of wonder. It's a great experience of the meaning of the cross and the meaning of redemption and what it means to belong to the kingdom of God. Then there's a man like Richard Baxter, for example, who I think he's the one that said that he had to preach every day as the message of forgiveness as a dying man to dying men. And his whole life was taken up with this experience that he'd had of the meaning of the forgiveness of sins and his desire, his burning desire to communicate this with people. Of course, it's true that some of the style in which this is written, kind of gets you. Oh, the full, the near, the sweet enjoyment is that of the affections, love and joy. It is near, for love is of the essence of the soul, and love is the essence of God, which is perfectly all right. But then he says, now the poor soul complains, oh, that I could love Christ more, but I cannot, alas.
I cannot. Yea, but thou canst. Now thy salvation is not perfected, not all the mercies purchased, yet given in. But when the top stone is set on, thou shalt with shouting cry, grace, grace. Well, no, this, you, when you read these people, you have to remember that they're writing in a different period from ours. These were 17th and 18th century people, and they had a lot of stylistic differences from what we're used to in our journalistic day. But on the other hand, you do learn something about yourself, and you learn something about the life in God, even by reading something that takes you a little while to try to figure out, what is he getting at? Interesting thing is that in this particular book, and why perhaps it's just as well we didn't use it, they include a lot of people that I would never have included. But I think their criterion was that of a somewhat of an aesthetic, as well as a Christian point of view. The people that I think you could best study, who are not really given very much time here, Martin Luther, he's given just a little tiny page because he wasn't particularly considered to be any great mystic. But you know why? Because he spent so much time talking about the scriptures. And you know, a real mystic, from the point of view of the tradition, usually talks about all the experiences they're having and all the beautiful feelings they're having. And Luther says, you know, don't trust your feelings. Can't depend on your feelings. You've got to depend on what Jesus Christ is saying to you in his word. Well, you know, this is something else again. So maybe that's why they didn't give him so much time. Luther isn't given ever very much time except with the Lutherans, if you want to know the truth. He's beginning to get some place amongst the Roman Catholics, however. That's good. Another man besides John Bunyan in the same period who wrote a rather delightful book and is one that it doesn't hurt to read. It's over in the library. Is a man named Thomas Traherne. He wrote a series of meditations, and he walked around and thought about nature and he thought about life, and then he wrote, each year he wrote a sort of a notebook of material telling about, you know, how he felt about this wonderful world that he lived in, but he was always aware that it was the gift of God, that he was not identifying with that nature, but that he was part of the creatures that had been created. This is an important thing to note in anything that you read that has a mystical quality, because it's the différence, as the French say, and I think this is the essential, are made very clear that God is wholly other than we are. That is, he is here and we are here. We don't become one in some great, beautiful unity except through the bridge of the cross. And when we forget that kind of experience, that there's a cross that makes the meeting possible, then we get into this completely almost pantheistic approach that you find in all the traditions, in all the different religions of the world, and that all have these same qualities of rhapsodic kind of union with the One, as they often call it. I usually kind of look when I'm reading anything that purports to be religious or Christian to see if there's any mention made of Jesus Christ. You know, he still is a scandal to the literary, to the intellectual, to the artist. All of us kind of think, well, you know, it'd be nice if we could just get around him and talk about God, you know, because God is such a nice inclusive figure, and there isn't any shame involved in that. The minute you say Jesus Christ, you get this kind of smelly feeling of, you know, you gotta be hung up with the New Testament, and you gotta be hung up with a lot of doctrines and all that sort of thing. You can talk about God, and you know, lots of people can say, yay, amen, you know, we're with you, sister. But you bring in Jesus Christ, and you begin to feel a little sort of a rusty nail there, and it's kind of a scratching sandpaper feeling. And so I do like to look at these different writings and see whether or not his name is mentioned. Because when he's mentioned, then I figure, well, I guess that guy, I could dig that man. I could like him because he's willing to say that this is the only way in which we do come to God. That we don't come any roundabout way, we don't come any LSD way, we don't come by way of any fast routes, and we don't come any way by any long pattern kind of routes. We only come as we get acquainted with the only God we really have ever known, and his name is Jesus Christ. I think it's probably time for the noon prayer fellowship and for some of you to go out and walk around and pray by yourselves and smell the air and get out of the confines of walls. So I am going to close, but I would like to suggest that there are a number of books over in the Koinonia Library. That's the library at the end of the hall in Koinonia. And there's a little sign that says Lay Seminar on it. And there's a mixture of books there. We don't feel we have to protect people. You've got to be sure you just read Luther, or you just read the kind of things I want you to read. There are lots of books over there, and you're most welcome to read them. We do request that you don't take them to your rooms. You can certainly take them into Koinonia in the living room part and read them, but please bring them back to the library itself, because some of them are personal copies, and the rest of them are copies that we would like to keep for the library. Very often, books that go into people's rooms get lost in the clothing or in something else, and they go home, and then you know how hard it is to find a post office. So unless we had a key attached to them, you could just drop it in the mailbox. it's hard to get them back. So, but do go over and investigate that Koinonia Library. It is a meditation room, and believe it or not, this is a retreat from talking to people, and you can get quite a lot out of being quiet and being by yourself, even if you're married or if you came with somebody that you like very much. Get away from each other and read something by yourself. Even if it's something you don't agree with. Maybe it's very good that you don't agree with it. But get by yourself so that you can do some thinking and meditating so that your own person does come into focus, particularly as it will come into focus in the presence of God and Jesus Christ. Thank you. We're going to have to clap. That might have been an entertainment, but it wasn't intended to be.